In the course of an average day, we each make over 35,000 decisions, which makes sense when you consider how difficult it is to figure out what to eat at the end of the day. I mean, you're exhausted, you're hangry, and you've already made, what, 20,000 decisions? Now you have to make one more, let alone figure out what your kids and your spouse might want to have at the same time. It's a nightmare. Recipe for conflict. Each day we have to figure out what we're going to eat, what we're going to wear, what we're going to buy, what we're going to say, what we're going to do first, what we're going to do, what we're going to not do. There's a lot that we have to figure out. A lot of decisions. Let alone the bigger ones. I mean, what should we believe? How should we vote? Who should we date or marry? How do we use our power and our privilege for good? Now, because we have so many of these decisions, we've developed different strategies to deal with them. Sometimes we impulsively just do the first thing that comes to mind. Other times we weigh the different options, or we simply comply with what someone else wants us to do or delegate. Hey, you figure this out. Or we avoid or deflect even having to make the decision. I put out on Facebook the question, how do you make a big decision? I loved reading all of the responses. There were some amazing and thoughtful things that were posted there. As I was reading through people's comments, I started making some notes, tallying up the major categories or ways people made big decisions. Number one, they trusted their gut. In second place, they went through some sort of rational, strategic process of making a decision. Number three, they brought in trusted advisors and companions to help them figure out what to do next. And so today I wanted to share with you three different ways that we can make big decisions. One focused on the mind, one focused on the body, and one focused on the soul. I want you to, as you're listening to these decisions, think about which one you fall in most likely, which is your go-to decision, and how you might learn something from the other strategies that are employed. Let's dive in. The first strategy involves our mind. Did you know that Charles Darwin, when he sat down to figure out whether or not he should marry his soon-to-be wife, he actually made a pro and con list? Under the heading, not marry, he noted the benefits of remaining a bachelor, including conversation with clever men at clubs. Under marry, he included children, if God pleases, and charms of female chit-chat. He lived in different times. But many of us use a pro and con list, but social scientists have found that our ability to just name pros and cons for any decision is not actually that evolved. So there's actually a better way. So here's a five-step process for you to make a better decision using your mind. First, articulate the problem in front of you. Step two, write down all of the possible options, even the ones you know you're definitely not going to take. When we're faced with a whether or not in which there's only two choices, we generally make worse decisions than when we have a which of many decision to make. In fact, scientists have found when studying decision-making in businesses that only 15% of people actually generate more possibilities, more alternatives, more ways of solving a specific problem after their initial brainstorm. But those 15% who do found a 66% confident rate in their decisions, rather than the 50% of those who didn't. Step three, invite the perspectives of a non-homogeneous, a diverse group of people. Studies have shown that when we come to a decision only with the perspectives of people who generally look like us, act like us, and come from the same backgrounds, those options are far more likely to be black and white and overconfident in their projections. When we invite a diverse range of racial backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, genders, sexualities, ages to the table, we in fact make better decisions. We might be less confident in the decisions we make, but that's because we're actually closer to the reality, which is these decisions are difficult. Homogeneous groups tend to settle on the most likely scenario. They don't test out their assumptions in the way that a diverse range of perspectives do. Step four, assess those assumptions through imagination. Now, you could just look at the different alternatives and say, what would be good about this and what would be bad about this? But then we're back to the pro-con list. And what that does is it just subjects yourself to your own cognitive biases. And so studies have found when you actually imagine the future as if you were living out that decision for a day or a week, or to kind of put yourself in an imaginative process in which you say, what would be better under this? What would be worse under this? And what might just get weird under this? When you imagine that future through the process of storytelling, Studies have found that we're more likely to find the faults in our own thinking and discover the gifts that we might not have thought were possible. Step 5. Okay, we're ready to finally make the decision. So we've articulated a lot of range of possibilities. We've brought in those diverse perspectives. We've been able to assess those perspectives based on imagining the future. And now we're going to do the final step of actually making the decision by creating a bunch of values. Okay, so here's what you do. The first step is you write down all of the values that are coming into play for you, the ones that are most important. Give each of those a score, which values are more important than others to you. And then rate each of the options that you're looking at on each of those values on a scale of, let's say, 1 to 10. Now multiply, I know this is complex, multiply the scores that they get by the importance of the value, and then add up all the totals, and there you have it. The decision is the one with the highest score. What are you telling me? What should I do? Tell me. Yes, the second strategy is trusting our body, or our gut, as most people would call it. Trust your gut. I mean, we've heard that over and over again, but I mean, a lot of us are suspicious of it, right? Like, why? Why should I trust these feelings that I have inside my body? Well, if you push aside all of the evidence from cultures from around the world through all of time about the importance of trusting our bodies, there's actually an emerging scientific consensus about why. And it's that we actually have a second brain. I know, a second brain, which is actually in our guts. This second brain is not just a metaphor, it is literally a second brain because of the complex neurons that we're finding in our digestive system. Now, we've been falsely taught in the West that our brain is where we think. And the best that we can do is just simply listen to our bodies. But that actually creates a divide, right? If we're listening to our bodies, it's like our body is different. I mean, we are our bodies. So if we say it more correctly, we're listening through our bodies. We've also been falsely taught that intelligence is about abstract reasoning. But what good is abstract reasoning when much of the world and much of ourselves isn't actually, well, reasonable? You can't reason your way to being present. You can't reason your way to love someone. You can't reason your way into fulfillment. All of these things that guide so much of the decisions that we make on an instinctual and also a deeply held level are not actually rational or reasonable. They're something else. Now, Shepherd's a researcher in this area, provides us with a different lens on intelligence. That the intelligence of the gut is about sensitivity, a grounded sensitivity, a sensitivity to emotions, to the movement, to beauty, to the emotional experiences of other people, the way in which ecosystems and animals and plants live in the world. It's a sensitivity to truth that lays beyond abstract thought. But this sensitivity isn't a static, permanent condition. It's actually something that can be developed or diminished. Anything that increases our ability to be embodied, to feel and be connected with all of the different parts of our bodies helps this sensitive intelligence, this intelligence that helps us be connect in to what is true beyond abstract thought. And Shepherd said that stillness is the precondition for sensitivity. That we need to find in our bodies a stillness. I mean, we carry around so much tension. I've been feeling it up in here recently. Sometimes I've got sciatica pain in my back and my legs. All of these things disconnect us. The loud sounds, the noise of the media, the screens that are all in front of us, all of this can disconnect us from listening to the intelligence of our bodies. And as someone wrote on Facebook, when we're connecting in to our bodies, we need to be able to distinguish the anxiety that we might be carrying about a decision from a message or the truth of how we feel. And so how do we do this? We do this by taking care of our bodies, of finding stillness, of moving, of releasing tension, of exercise, of massage, of nourishing our bodies. All of these practices that have been passed down from generations to generations, from culture to culture, that help us get deeply connected to what is true about ourselves so that our sensitivity, our sensitive intelligence can guide us. So that when we ask and receive a gut sense about what decision we should go through, it is the truth. Sometime when the river is ice, ask me mistakes I have made, the poet William Safford writes. Ask me whether what I have done is my life. Others have come in their slow ways into my thoughts. Some have tried to help or hurt. Ask me what difference their strongest love or hate has made.
I will listen to what you say. You and I can turn and look at the silent river and wait. We know the current is there, hidden. And there are comings and goings from miles away that hold the stillness exactly before us. Discernment is this third practice that helps us answer that question, whether what we have done is our life. Discernment is the process of understanding what the unique gifts we have are and how our lives intersect with the movement of courageous love. Discernment helps us find that alignment. It doesn't give us an objective answer to a question, but instead it gives us a unique one to us in our being. Parker Palmer, the Quaker teacher, says there's a unique violence that we visit upon ourselves and in turn others when we live a life that is not ours. Discernment is the process of understanding what that is. So the first step in discernment is getting in touch with that inner self. Parker writes, in our culture, we tend to gather information in ways that do not work very well when the source is the human soul. The soul is not responsive to subpoenas or cross-examinations. At best, it will stand in the dock only long enough to plead the Fifth Amendment. At worst, it will jump bail and never be heard of again. The soul speaks its truth only under quiet, inviting, and trustworthy conditions. The soul is like a wild animal, tough, resilient, savvy, self-sufficient, yet exceedingly shy. If we want to see a wild animal, the last thing we should do is to go crashing through the woods, shouting for the creature to come out. But if we are willing to walk quietly into the woods and sit silently for an hour or two at the base of a tree, the creature we are waiting for may well emerge. And out of the corner of our eye, we will catch a glimpse of the precious wildness we seek. In stillness, in prayerful contemplation, ways of being that push away the noise of the world of other people's stories so that we can get in touch with ourselves, whatever the practice is, we allow ourselves to take that first step to encounter ourselves, maybe for the first time. The second step in discernment is to trust that that inner teacher that Parker Palmer speaks of will show up, that the soul within us has a wisdom that we need not any other. And yet we need companions to help elicit that. And so the third step is to invite the companionship of others to hear our experimentations with truth and true self, to witness them and to invite us deeper through questions and reflections, to gift us a question that helps us experience ourselves in a new way, rather than trying to fix or save or set us straight, not directing us, but inviting us. In classical Christian discernment, there are a few signs that say that we might have arrived at the right place. The first is a sense of God's peace, or a sense of contentment or joy or even energy. The second is the persistence of the message that what we have come to know about our true self comes with us not just for a moment, but with the weight of truth in many moments. The third is a convergence of truth, that this truth isn't just seen from within ourselves, but it is affirmed in many different ways and fashions, even sometimes in the prayerful contemplations of others. And the fourth is a fruitfulness, that when we live into that truest self, it bears fruit, not immediately, not in the way we might have thought, but that it does bear fruit. Find the stillness, encounter ourselves, invite others to help us, and seek the signs in our lives for the decision we seek. Now, the interesting thing about these three different ways of making a decision is that there's some common threads. The first is the ability to sort out signal and noise, what is important and what is not. The second is involving other people, each of them in their own ways, one to help us with our cognitive biases, one to help us connect to our deepest selves, one to help us engage in practices that allow us to be in tune with our bodies, that there is a limitation in just relying on one source of information. So I'm wondering, what's that big decision that you are putting off? I wonder which strategy you might employ and who the right companions would be.